Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Back in the late 1950s, Mao Zedong, the leader of China, announced a plan to aggressively modernize the country in both the agricultural and industrial sectors. And it came to be called the Great Leap Forward. And it turned out basically to be a disaster for a variety of reasons. There was widespread famine. Millions of people starved, in part because farm workers were pulled off the farm and reassigned to factory work. The environment suffered as a result of this as well, as the demand for wood led to widespread deforestation. This morning in this hour, we'll be talking a bit about the ecological consequences of the Great Leap Forward. And our guest for the program is Peter Huntoon. He's emeritus professor in the Department of Geophysics at the University of Wyoming. And he is here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk on this subject. It is in part sponsored by the folks at the Center for Advanced Study, part of a series that they're using to explore the idea of the mega disaster, and this is one of them. He's going to be giving a talk today on the U of I campus, and we'll have more on that. I'll mention more on that for people who would be interested in attending. It's certainly open to the public, and anybody who is interested should feel welcome. It's going on at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. That's this afternoon, November 29th, at 4 in the afternoon, and it is the museum is located at 600 South Gregory in Urbana, and these programs, they're always free and open to the public, so anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Here on the program this morning, questions are welcome too, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you certainly should feel welcome to call. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here.
Appreciate it. I know we probably, if this were talking about Chinese history, we probably could spend a lot of time talking about the Great Leap Forward. And maybe, though, we should just do a thumbnail sketch for people who aren't familiar with this chapter in modern Chinese history. What's important to know about the Great Leap Forward?
Well, the Great Leap Forward was a five-year plan that Mao instituted in 1958, and it ran through about 1963. And his goal was to modernize China, and his emphasis was on building railroads, which was really their equivalent of our interstate highway system. So they built a magnificent and an extensive railroad system that connected all the provinces of China, and that was a major step forward.
Mm-hmm. And for this, there was a tremendous demand for steel, obviously, to build rail and rolling stock and so forth. And I think one of the things that he was determined to do these two things and do these two things at once. One was this enormous increase in agricultural production, but the other one was this enormous increase in particularly in steel production. And at one point, he was saying that he thought that they could get to the point where they could equal or exceed the steel input of Britain or something like that. It was an extraordinarily and turned out to be a disastrous goal in the end that he had set.
Yeah, well, now from our perspective of what we're talking about today, the steel was central. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, to build a railroad, you needed enormous amounts of concrete. So they had to also process limestone. So the whole idea is they had these two commodities, steel and limestone, that they were going to process, and they needed something to fuel this effort. That's the big deal.
And that's where the wood and all this enormous cutting of wood comes in.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. The idea is everybody knows that China's got a lot of coal. That's pretty much up in the north. But what they really didn't know how they wanted to go after getting fuel for this thing. And Mao himself was from South China. That's where he was born and raised. And he knew South China, and he knew that it was covered with this enormous forest. And I guess what he did is he just waved his hand over it and said, use that forest. It's not good for anything. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they turned out tens of thousands of people to start cutting in 1958, and they just started mowing this place.
What kind of area are we talking about?
We're probably talking about an area that's about 2 to 3 times the size of the state of Colorado. that was just all the woods that were on it were cut off.
We're just clear cut.
Just cut it to the last tree. They didn't leave anything.
And this is something that started now in the late 1950s.
It started in 58, and by 1959, they had just about cut them all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they still hadn't reached Mao's quotas for steel. Now, what they were doing, they were cutting the forest. They were turning the wood into charcoal, which means you have to fire it and make charcoal out of it. And then they were shipping the charcoal to small smelters that they set up. And they were using low-grade ores. So they had a vast population that was working on that as well. And these were very inefficient, and they were turning out crummy quality pig iron, which was being sent to their steel mills and turned into rail and things like that, and you know, construction materials. But anyway, they were just wholesale turning this forest into charcoal. Mm. And the thing that got interesting was when they ran out of the wood, they still needed more. And this is where the story gets incredible. It took me a long time to figure this out. They sent the peasants back out into the forest, and these people hand dug up every single stump and turned that into charcoal too. You can imagine the effort that was involved.
And now this is the consequences of this. I suppose the important bottom line is the consequences of this remain to this day.
Oh yeah, they're still reeling from this.
Yeah,
we can talk about that. There's lots of lines of inquiry on that, but. One of the things that we might talk to your audience about here is the immediate impact of this. The people that were involved in this effort down in South China were, of course, the peasant farmers. So they were turned out of their fields and turned into the woods. And the immediate result was that there were very few people left to actually cultivate crops. That was a serious issue. And so they went through a couple of seasons without getting good crops in. And so this is setting the place up for a terrible famine. And then another curious thing, and I heard about this from people I talk with down there, the people had to have these iron quotas come out of these smelters. And they couldn't meet those very well either because the ores they were using were so poor quality. So what the peasants started doing is melting down their tools to bulk up the supply of output. So they were destroying their ability to till the land once they got out of this program.
Yeah.
And the result was when they finished, they were absolutely prostrate. They couldn't, they just didn't have enough food, and a terrible famine ensued.
And it's really sad, and this business of the backyard steel furnace was really the key element here. That apparently at one point someone showed Mao one of these little furnaces and said, "Well, we can make steel this way," and which apparently was a fraud. Actually, I think as I read the story, the steel that was said to have come from this furnace, in fact, didn't. But he got this idea of that'd be great. That way we can increase our production by putting these furnaces, putting it in people's backyards, or a neighborhood could have furnace, or if you had a farm, you could have one of these furnaces. And that the idea was that individual people virtually in their spare time, but in addition to everything else they were doing, were also supposed to be making steel. The problem was that the steel that came out of them was virtually
worthless. Yeah, it wasn't good.
Yeah,
that's true. Well, the idea is that the one thing Mao had to work with was this enormous population, and he just saw it as turn the ants out on the hill and they can remove it, and that's exactly what they did.
He had this enormous labor force to apply to the
right.
The problem.
And he had very little regard for them. He just saw them as labor.
Well, going back to what happened first initially when they went in and cut all the trees and that wasn't enough, and then they went back and they dug out the stumps, that it would make it sound like in the areas where this forest had stood, that's virtually like sterilizing it. I'm sure that they didn't remove all vegetation. But what exactly, what does this area look like now?
Well, it's barren. What we want to do is talk about the magnitude of this for a moment. Each individual that was out there working had a quota of turning out 1 cubic meter of wood a day. So if you have 1,000 people out there, that's 1,000 cubic meters. That's a lot of wood that's coming out of a small area. And that's the impact we're talking about. And it took those guys long hours to produce that quota. And so this is really serious thing. What they typically did is they cut everything. Now, this area that we're talking about is very hilly. It's not high mountains. The hills stick up. They're very jagged peaks. They stick up about as much as 500 feet above the plains, and they were completely tree-covered. Very difficult terrain to work in. But what they did is they cut them to the last stick, so there was absolutely nothing left. Then they uprooted the trees. So what little soil was left on these hills was now completely exposed, and it was subject to erosion. So they increased their erosion as a result, and that was destructive to agriculture as well.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that what this does is this gives you a case study of seeing what would happen with a radical, profound kind of deforestation, the kind of thing that you wouldn't really want to do. You couldn't reproduce this experimentally, I would imagine, to something of this degree. But it does give you an opportunity to ask questions of, well, okay, if you do that, then what happens?
Well, you know, we do have analogs for that in the West, and if we have a really hot forest fire that has the capability to burn out the roots and to completely remove the organic mat that lies on the forest floor, then you'll clear an area just about as effectively as the Chinese did in this deforestation. But when we take a look at even the worst forest fires we have in the West these days, and we've had some bad ones in the last couple of years, in surface area, they don't match the devastation that this particular program wrought.
Let me introduce again our guest, Peter Huntoon. He's a professor in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Wyoming. He's here to talk about this issue that we've been talking about, the deforestation that took place in southern China as a result of the Great Leap Forward and what that meant for the environment. This is part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative on Mega Disasters, and he'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, looking at your background and the things that you've studied, I see that you're a hydrogeologist. You're interested in groundwater issues and things like that. How did you become interested in this particular subject, Great Leap Forward and deforestation in southern China?
Well, this was a situation that I simply came in through the back door with no knowledge at all. My area of expertise is I'm a groundwater explorationist. I'm the kind of guy that you call up to find out where to drill. And I've always been interested in that. And one of the areas that I'm particularly interested in are locating wells and water supplies in limestone terrains. And South China has some of the finest exposed limestone terrain in the world. So it's world class, world famous. And I went there to a conference in 1988 to view this stuff almost as a tourist. And I got there and really enjoyed myself. We had a week-long conference. And towards the end of the conference, a man named Ru Jinwen put up a notice that he would like to talk to people about possible academic exchanges. And out of this conference that had maybe 1,500 people, two or three of us showed up to talk with this fellow. And this was one of those lucky things that you do. So I was talking with him. He was trying to get an exchange going where he could bring in some people that could bring with him expertise on locating water in difficult terrains. And they considered this to be difficult. And it was just a matter of sitting there and either saying yes or no. And, of course, I thought, this sounds like a great ticket. So I said yes. And a couple of years later, they brought me over for 3 months to look things over. When I arrived, we started going through this fabulous scenic terrain with all these high towers, and they were full of caves. It was a very dramatic thing for me. And as I was looking at it, after several weeks, I started asking the question, you get between 3 and 6 feet of rain here every year. Where are the trees? I haven't seen any. And then this story started to reveal itself to me. And I thought, I've never read about this. I don't know anything about this. This is really interesting. And so I started looking at it. And as I started taking pictures of it. And I started recording what I was seeing. And after about 2 months, I realized that, you know, there's good science here. But there's also a news story here. And I got to get this recorded. And so when I finally left after 3 months, I had about 7 or 8 rolls of film with the story on the rolls. And when I got back to the States, I published this, and an academic took 1.5 years to come out. And it was news. And a lot of people got very interested in it as a result.
Mm-hmm. Well, what can you learn from this? There are probably some variety of things that obvious things. As a scientist, what do you think you can learn from studying this story?
Well, I'll tell you, you can get right down to the basic human level. I was out in a small village in the middle of nowhere one day, and we came across an old Chinese ecologist who had been through the whole thing. He was 10, 15 years older than I am. Right now, I'm 64, so I'm old. But anyway, this was he was in his 60s when I met him back then. And this guy started talking to me through an interpreter. And the last thing he said to me was, "You've got to get this story out so that they never do it again." Mm-hmm. And what he was saying is, you don't want to do it again where you're from. Mm-hmm. And the lesson that they had learned was that once they lost their forest, they had also lost their water supply. We'll talk about that. The forest is the green reservoir. We should talk about that a little bit. But what they did is they permanently impoverished this region. And we're talking about a populated wilderness, but this populated wilderness has between 100 and 150 million people. And they left these people impoverished forever.
So there's no going back on this now? There's no possibility of doing restoration? Or perhaps the question is, well, in some small sense maybe, but you could never get it back to what it was?
Yeah, what they've tried reforestation. They've tried aerial seeding. They did that right away in the late 50s. They flew over and threw seeds out, and that worked a little bit. But then that didn't work well enough. And in desperation, what they ultimately did is go in there and start hand planting trees back on this where they could. And they had enormous projects to plant trees, but the thing is, they could only scratch the surface. When I was there, maybe 3%, 4%, 5% of the land had been reforested through hand plantings. And the hand plantings were extremely difficult for them, because what they'd done is they destroyed the soils underneath the forest. I might take a minute to explain that, because mm-hmm. those of you in the Midwest are very familiar with this, with your cropping patterns. When you have a forest, the forest is growing on an organic mat that sits on top of a soil. And in this particular area, the soils are very poor. They're very clay-rich. And because of the heavy rains, those soils are just about depleted of their nutrients. So the thing that counts is the organic debris that lands on the forest floor from the leaves and things falling off the trees that's decaying. And all the roots are growing through that organic mat and drawing their nutrients from that. When they cut the forest, the organic mat was exposed to the sun, and it dried up, and it literally blew away. And they had nothing but this clay. This hard red clay. And then the sun down there hit that in the summer, and it literally baked that stuff into a consistently like a adobe brick. Mm-hmm. And now they go in to try to plant something on that. You have no nutrients, and you have a soil that's unreceptive to a plant. So they had a very difficult time trying to fix this problem. Another issue that they had was, in the meantime, the people are still there, and they use fuel, a wood as their fuel. They're on a wood fuel economy down there. So they've got to burn something. So what they were doing is they were continually going out, and any regrowth, they were cutting it off as fast as it was coming up. So the population spends a significant portion of every year going out and cutting everything they can get and bringing us in to use as fuel. One thing they stopped doing is any space heating. They don't burn fuel to heat their homes. That's taboo. They only use it to cook the essentials. So they sit there in heavy coats in the winter and meagerly feed in straw into their fire to cook with. And what that means is that these people have to literally mow the whole place every year just to make a meager supply of fuel.
Let's talk with a caller here. We have somebody who'd like to jump into the conversation on our line number one. They're in Urbana, here where we are, on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Mm-hmm.
The communists back in Mao's time were probably pretty nasty people, but you know, somewhere along the line, I've heard of this disaster, but not at the scale you're talking about it. Can you talk about the modern China? I noticed there was someone here on the radio about a month ago who was talking about the West Coast and how China's current pollution is polluting like Rainier and all these, you know, West Coast U.S. cities and stuff, and particulate matter in Los Angeles and stuff. I mean, are the Chinese ever going to get a hold of this stuff before it gets so bad that it basically causes major environmental collapse in the whole eastern, you know, Asian area? I mean, that sounds real pessimistic, but I'm maybe leaning into some of the latest literature in, you know, about the environment and global warming and all this other stuff. But could you speak about, to address that issue too, since you've been there recently?
Well, you have to understand that, of course, China is a developing nation, and they're trying to get themselves up to a Western standard. So what we're trying to do is convert all those billions of people into people that are driving cars and living a high life. And if they do it on the scale that we've done it, obviously they're going to be a major factor. And I've heard, and I'm not expert on this at all, but I've heard that in about 20 or 30 years, the amount of pollution that will be coming out of China is going to be equal to the amount of pollution that we're producing over here in terms of deteriorated air quality.
Yeah.
So they're going to be a major factor, and they want it. They watch television. They know what the good life is, and they're all striving for it just like we are.
Mm-hmm.
And just like us, they have a population that's growing geometrically. The population of China is probably going to double in about the next 20 years, which means that we're looking at about 5 billion of them.
Yeah.
And we're already up just a little over 5 billion for the total on the planet today. So this is big news coming our way. One friend of mine put it this way. He said, hey, you know, the freight train was loaded 20 years ago, and it's coming full steam ahead, and we're waiting for it to arrive in a station.
Yeah. I'm just more pessimistic than that. I just can't understand how. I mean, the government itself seems to not have the capability to respond to the locals. What I'm going by is there's a China expert on about a month ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago. He was talking about I had called him and asked about all the riots that are going on in rural China in reference to expropriation of land by the government for industrial purposes and just throwing these farmers and all these, you know, small plot farmers are disappearing and all this stuff because, you know, they're just basically saying, the hell with you. And as you said earlier, the water quality there is not good because of this deforestation. So, I mean, do you really think that they can support 5 billion people? I mean, do you think the environment is just, I don't know. It just seems to me like the environment is going to one day just collapse, you know, and we're all going to start dying in numbers that are unimaginable to us now. I mean, I know it sounds pessimistic, but I just look at these numbers and think it's getting bad now, and how can it get any worse without killing off huge amounts of people? I mean, I maybe it's out of your purview, but I just wanted to ask you that question. Thank you.
Well, I can talk to this on a philosophical level, and the way you want to, if you want to have any hope at all, is realize that developing countries will mature just like the United States matured. And we had polluted everything we could pollute, and finally we instituted the Environmental Protection Agency, and they started to try to correct this. And we saw noticeable improvements in air quality in our major cities. Now, a problem that we have here is that we've relaxed the standards on that over the last couple of decades, and now we're starting to get back to bad air again. I live in Las Vegas, where the air is absolutely terrible. But the idea is that China's also going to mature to this. And at one point, they're going to say, we can't afford to not take care of our environment, and we're going to start pursuing environmental quality regulations and try to clean this up. That's my hope. Because nobody wants to have their citizens dying unnecessarily. And we don't, and they don't. And it's just having the political will to do the job. And in this line, a government, and it doesn't matter if it's a capitalist government or a communist government, the government really does listen to its people and it tries to give them what it wants. And right now, the Chinese citizens want this thing called progress. They want to look like what they see on a TV screen from the West. And consequently, the government's listening and it's doing it. And there's a cost to that.
I want to appreciate the comments of the last caller, and we have somebody we'll get on to in just a moment. We're here at our midpoint, though, and I want to introduce again our guest, Peter Huntoon. He's a geologist. He's a groundwater geologist. He is a retired professor from the Department of Geology and Geophysics at University of Wyoming. He is here visiting the campus to talk about this story. It's something that he became interested in some time ago, and that was the ecological effects of massive deforestation that took place in southern China as a part of the Great Leap Forward, this effort in the late 50s into the early 60s to rapidly industrialize the country, also develop the country's agriculture. And one result, because of the tremendous demand for fuel, was virtually clear-cutting an enormous area of forest in the southern part of China that had devastating effects on the environment and environmental effects that persist to this very day. He is here to talk about this. It's a talk that's part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative on Mega Disasters. And he'll be getting his talk this afternoon at 4 at the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. These are always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We do have another caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation, too. This is also someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello. Caller there in Urbana, line 2? No, perhaps not. Let's get back to our conversation here, and of course, anybody who's listening can call. Something that I want to make sure that we talk about here, because it is, after all, your area of specialty is water. What was the relationship between this area that you're talking about and its geology, which is apparently a good water reservoir, a good groundwater reservoir? The relationship between that and the forest that was there. And then I suppose the question is, well, then what happened when the forest was gone?
Well, that's the real key issue for me. I got over there and I was asked to join them in the research effort because they were trying to find new water supplies. And I found that ironic because I'm coming from the desert where we have 6 to 8 inches a year, and they were having 3 to 6 feet of rain a year. And I thought, what's the problem? You've got enough water. You ought to be swimming in it. But the thing that they taught me, and this is the greatest lesson I've had in all of ecology, was not to see the forest as a bunch of wood, but to see it as a green reservoir. Mm-hmm. And the forest has a capacity to store enormous amounts of water. When the rain falls, a little water gets hung up in the leaves. It eventually gets down to the organic mat under the trees, and it sits there and slowly seeps into the groundwater system or slowly moves off to the streams. So the trees have a capacity to tie up a lot of water that falls on them and gradually release them to the hydrologic systems like the groundwater systems and the streams. And once you remove the trees, then the water just simply hits the ground and makes a run for the nearest stream and flows out of the area. So what we saw down there was the lag time between when the water landed during the rainy season in the winter and when it was gone oftentimes was shorter than the beginning of the next wet season. So they were having serious flash flooding when the rain was coming down. And then when they passed out of their wet season, they were going into a terrible hot drought. And they simply ran out of water 3 months before the next rainy season started, instead of having the forest carry them through, which it used to do. And this was a major impact for them. So they had to start figuring out ways to develop new water supplies.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that this had an effect on the microclimate of southern China. Did that effect, were there larger climatic effects that were regional but big?
Yeah, that was a major issue that they kept hammering on me. When you visit a subtropical rainforest like this place used to be, you can find them in Thailand, for example, today. You can go there at any season, and the temperatures are going to be around, the cold temperatures will be in the 50s or 60s, but the summer temperatures in the forest are going to be somewhere around 80 or 90 degrees. It'll be humid, but it'll be 80 or 90, and I found it very pleasant when I got in those forests. And then you can be there in the middle of August, and it's going to be 80 to 90 degrees because the energy is being soaked up by the leaves and converted into chlorophyll and food for the tree, and you're not getting hot on the ground. When they cut the forest, what happened was wind velocities increased, the moisture went to the floor, and temperatures went up. So when we got out there in some of these areas, the temperatures were running between 110 to 120 degrees in the summer, up 30 to 40 degrees over what they normally would be. And that baked out the soil, and it also evaporated whatever water was left. So on the region, here was a region that's getting 3 to 6 feet of rain a year, and it was actually starting to undergo desertification.
Yeah, that was just my thought. Yeah, we're talking about here, literally, they made a desert out of it.
Exactly. And it looks like a desert. It looks like the Southwest when you fly over it today, because there's so much exposed rock.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Next is someone over in Savoy, nearby community. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you are aware that the United States preceded China by 40, 50 years in deforesting the Great Southwest, the Plain States, that turned into the Dust Bowl. And that was not due to communist decisions, but to the so-called free market. During World War I, when the price of wheat and commodities went up so high, everybody flocked to homestead the free land out in the formerly grasslands, plowed up the grass and exposed the sod to dust, and for several years raised very profitable crops. And after the Great Depression, when the next huge drought blew in, it took the topsoil all the way to the East Coast in the Atlantic Ocean. And this went on through the drought years for 8-10 years and virtually made it a no man's land.
Well, your point is well made. Every civilization has had their experience with deforestation, and that's just one of them that's occurred here in the United States. And we can go back through civilizations and see where they cut their trees and they literally collapsed their civilizations.
All right.
Let me give you one really interesting historic example. All of you have heard about the Cedars of Lebanon in the Bible.
Yes.
And 4,000 years ago, you could have walked from Ethiopia to Spain and been in the shade all the way along the top of the northern Mediterranean. And today, all of that is a desert like the Southwest. And major civilizations, the Greek civilization, collapsed because they cut all their trees. And this is nothing new. What we're really talking about here is human beings have a very short attention span, and they don't really learn these lessons from the past. And the lessons are all over our history books if we're just willing to read the lesson.
Well, we still haven't seemed to have learned from the experience in the Southwest Plains, because after some soil conservation programs during the FDR years, there was some recovery. And the people learned how to drilled down deep to the Oglala Aquifer, which is now being depleted, and they're growing cotton out there for an export crop. And our government subsidizes the large agribusinesses that produce this cotton. They're depleting the reservoir, the underground reservoir, and depleting the soil again. And it just seems that we never learn.
Well, I've been a real student of the Midwest for years because I did 4 years at the University of Nebraska when I first started my career, and I really have a great affinity for it. One of the things that we were very aware of when I was young at that point in the 70s was they planted all the tree windrows across the West to slow the winds down and to take care of things. And what I've noticed in the last 10 years or so is everybody's cutting them down to get them out of the way because they're such a nuisance. And that doesn't seem like that's going in the right direction either.
Well, that was FDR's big solution to the Dust Bowl. And I used to, I'm from Oklahoma, I used to see these rows of trees way out in the middle of nowhere. And I asked my dad, what were the trees doing there? And he said they were planted by the CCC in the soil conservation. But apparently they're gone now.
Yeah, they're starting to cut them down. Because they're such a nuisance. They take up space, and they, you know, they're old, and they have to maintain them.
So and they didn't do any good, apparently.
Well, they did a lot of good. They reduced the wind velocities, and that was their key role. Well, your comments are wonderful.
Well, a lot of this is recorded in a recent book by Timothy Egan called The Worst Hard Time. And he just last week was awarded the Pulitzer, the National Book Award for that book. I recommend it to you.
Well, one thing that you mentioned was the dust getting to Washington, D.C. And I had heard that. But finally, about 2 years ago, I saw photographs of that in the National Archives, these big billowing clouds going right over D.C. From Oklahoma. And our last caller was talking about the dust and particulates getting all the way across the Pacific Ocean from China. And that's a fact. They've traced them.
I lived in East Oklahoma, and I never will forget gritting that soil between my teeth when I was a child. And apparently it went to the East Coast.
Oh, yeah, on extremes it did.
Well, thank you. It's nice to hear your discussion.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on and talk with someone here next in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Good morning. Hi. Mm-hmm. This brings to mind the story of Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union, where it seemed political ideology was trumping science, and we seem to have current examples as well with evidence of science suggesting global warming being ignored by this administration. So my question is, when you were learning about this case, did you find out about were there scientists advising Mao against this, or was that political suicide? What was happening there with the dynamic in terms of this decision being made and the scientific evidence available?
Well, of course, that's something that I couldn't get into firsthand. All I could do is get the anecdotal stories that were told to me. But Mao was a very powerful autocrat and a very a guy with very little patience. And one thing that happened was when he made a decision that was bad, his advisors and the people that carried it out didn't have the courage to tell him that there was a problem. So he was oblivious to the damage until some time after it occurred. And then he was rather indifferent after he learned about it. So it wouldn't have probably mattered that much anyway. But we do see that kind of myopia in a lot of our leaders.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Peter Huntoon. He's emeritus professor in the Department of Geophysics at University of Wyoming and is here to give a talk about this subject, about the environmental consequences of deforestation that took place during the Great Leap Forward in China in the late 1950s, early 1960s. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon on the U of I campus, so people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana are welcome to attend. And calls here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, again, I think I did ask the question about whether there had been attempts at remediation, and you said, in fact, that there had been some. In fact, right away, they attempted to recede, but that the kind of impact on the ecology made it apparently virtually impossible to do very much about it, and the scale was so big that essentially what we had is a place that had been a tropical rainforest area, or that now literally is a desert. Is there truly no hope for this region?
Well, what they have to do is keep the people out of the woods. That's what they've got to do. And the thing is, when we take a look at this particular region of China, the Great Leap Forward was just part one of a three-part story. Mm-hmm. What happened next in 1966 is they had the Cultural Revolution. And the Cultural Revolution literally turned the country over to the peasants, and there was a virtual anarchy there. Mm-hmm. And this lasted for 10 years until 1976. Well, the peasants in South China saw this as an opportunity to go out and exploit the woods, which they'd been forbidden to go into. And so they went out there and they cut the last of what was left. And so by the time the Cultural Revolution was over, the place had been hit hard for a second time. And then the third step was in 1979, they decollectivized the farms. And that allowed the peasants to disperse out into the countryside. And, of course, there was a mass migration of people trying to get away from the collectives and to set up their own homes. And when they left, obviously, they moved towards the woods and cut the woods down to make their new homes. So the place got hit again in 1979. So by the time I got there, it was pretty wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the whole idea is that, yes, there could be restoration here. You would have to impose very very harsh regulations to keep people out of there, and you'd have to supply them alternative fuels. And that could work, I suppose. And they were importing a lot of coal into this area when I was there. They would bring it down by the train load and just leave it parked along the tracks, and people could come and take what they wanted. That was a sort of a stopgap measure to help protect the trees. But the real issue there is population. They've got 100, 150 million people living in this area, about the size of three Colorados. That's a heavy population, and that thing is going to double in 20 years. So the demands are going to just keep increasing. The resource is finite, and the numbers of people is just going through the roof.
Mm. Let's take some other calls here. Someone who's calling on from cell phone. They're on the road on I-57, so we'll go there, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm going to sidetrack you a little bit. You mentioned you're a hydrologist, and my concerns are this. I know you're talking about deforestation in China, but I'd like to talk about a subject that's really close to home here. The United States at this point in time is going through a process of building a large amount of ethanol plants, and each one of those plants require a lot of water to process the products into ethanol. And invariably, that's going to affect aquifers. Have you looked into this project at all? And how many of these plants can we tolerate?
Well, you're talking about something that I know absolutely nothing about. I wish I could say something, but I can't do it.
Okay, that's fine. I just in my thoughts, it appears as though we might be setting ourselves up for the exact same situation that China jumped into without really thinking it through, and we may find ourselves in the exact same point, only with water instead of trees.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I think this is certainly something that we have talked about on the program before. Regional water issues. I'm sure it's something that we'll be getting back to again. That's the folks here. We have this organization that's called the Illinois State Water Survey, and it's based here on the campus, and that's one of the things that they're very interested in. And I'm sure in future we'll be talking about that again, because it is an issue here for our area, because there's some talk about putting in an ethanol plant and their questions about the water that it would use. And I'm sure that that would be an issue other places as well. And I suppose the exploitation and use of groundwater is just a general issue. A lot of places where there has been a lot of urbanization, where there are more people, so there's more demand for water. It's used in agriculture, so it's a big issue. And I think that more and more it'll become an issue that in the past, in places where in the past it was not. People in the West, they're used to thinking about water. Here we have had this luxury of not having to think about it. Well, I'm thinking maybe the day that day is coming to an end.
Yeah, water is going to be the reckoning factor for our civilization. It always has been.
Let's talk.
And it's going to be worth something to us.
Let's talk with somebody in Peoria. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When Rivers Run Dry is a book that our book club just read, and I was curious what you had observed about the silt that you were describing coming off these strip mountains affecting the rivers. The book had mentioned, for example, that that one of their rivers was now 65 feet above the surrounding land. I was just wondering what sort of problems you see developing there in China due to this sort of activity.
Well, that's a major factor, and the Yellow River is called the Yellow River for a good reason, because it's got such a heavy silt load. And, of course, this was a major factor, and it still is a major factor, is soil erosion. So they've got a lot of soil going out to the ocean, and of course, that's another resource that they're losing in big time. And deforestation in other areas of Southeast Asia is a major factor. For example, the old country of Burma is heavily deforested now because the opium growers are going out there and doing slash and burn, put in a crop, and move on to the next hill the next year. And all the silt that's blowing out of there through the river systems goes down to Bangladesh. And if it weren't for that heavy silt load going into Bangladesh, Bangladesh would start to go underneath the ocean, because the input of silt every year keeps building up the mud bars that enormous population lives on. This is a major factor, and that just gives you one example of an area that is a measurable example of how much silt goes down river systems from these deforested areas.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, and let's go to someone here in Indiana, Mill Creek Valley, Indiana. Line two. Hello.
Yeah. Very interesting, and I'm certainly in agreement, you know, with the idea of probably using up our water and using up our soil, and I try to conserve what I've got on my little farm. But I wanted to you might recommend to your readers or to your audience, I'm sure you've already seen it. It's a pamphlet put out by the United States Department of Agriculture and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the NRCS. Conquest of the Land Through 7,000 Years. And, oh, there's some striking photographs in there. I'm looking at the front cover, and my gosh, here's the ruins of some ancient city. Here's pillars, walls, and all around it's just nothing. So if you don't know that, I think you'd be interested in reading it, and I'd recommend it to any readers.
Okay. Well, tell us again. This is something that's published by USDA?
Yeah. And also the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service. I would imagine they could get it from their extension agent.
Uh-huh. And what's it called?
Conquest of the Land Through 7,000 Years.
Okay.
And boy, you know, it shows you these civilizations and nothing left but ruins, and the land is hopeless, and oh, boy.
Yeah. Well, that's something earlier that Professor Huntu, you know, talked about how the story of deforestation goes back a long way, back into the ancient world, certainly.
Yeah. It sure did. Well, thanks.
Well, I appreciate the call.
Yeah, thanks very much. I wasn't aware of that one. I got to get it.
Yeah. Well, we're just about the point that we're going to have to end our conversation here because we've come to the end of the time. Any last thought that you'd like to leave with folks here?
No, I'm just tickled to be with you today, and it's awful nice to have an audience out there to talk to.
All right. Well, we appreciate your being here, Peter Huntoon. He's emeritus professor in the Department of Geophysics at University of Wyoming. He is here to give a talk. This is a part of the Center for Advanced Studies Initiative on Mega Disasters, talking about Chairman Mao, the Great Leap Forward, and the deforestation ecological disaster in the South China Karst. And that'll be today, 4 o'clock this afternoon. He'll be speaking in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. These programs are always free and open to anybody who would like to attend. Again, thanks very much. We certainly appreciate it.